The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this Monday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up, as Georgia schools respond to rising coronavirus cases, well, there's one local district that's offering free COVID-19 testing for staff, students, and families. I'll speak with Marietta City School Superintendent Dr. Grant Rivera. Plus, how Black-owned businesses are coping during the pandemic and how new diverse startups can create social impact. And speaking of diversity and inclusion, coming up, it's on the agenda for Dragon Con this weekend. We'll talk about all that, those conversations and more. But first this, Georgia can expect heavy rain and wind gusts in the next couple of days as Ida makes its way inland after striking Louisiana. Matt Sinna is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Peachtree City.
Main threat for us is going to be the potential for some very heavy rain across the far northern part of the state. And the potential by early tomorrow morning, some potential for an isolated tornado in some of these storms that come through.
Now, of course, Ida has weakened to a tropical storm after leaving New Orleans without power yesterday. The National Weather Service says in Georgia, there is a potential for flash flooding and possibly, now brief, spin-up tornadoes today through tomorrow. We'll keep you updated through all of that. The metro Atlanta area is predicted to get between an inch and an inch and a half of rain by Wednesday. The worst of the storms will be concentrated in the northwest portion of the state. By the way, from Georgia Power, we've learned that they've already started sending crews to the Mississippi coast to help with restoration. And in other news from our WABE newsroom, the man accused of killing 8 people in Atlanta area spa businesses appeared in Fulton County Court today. Robert Long faces a possible death penalty, as well as hate crimes and domestic terrorism charges. Long already pleaded guilty to murder charges in Cherokee County, where he shot and killed 4 people, in Fulton County, where he allegedly shot and killed 4 more people. Now, most of the victims were of Asian descent. And District Attorney Fani Willis has maintained she plans to seek the death penalty. She addressed the media earlier today following Long's court appearance.
I want the Asian community to know, in all of the community, if you're Hispanic, if you're African American, if you're a woman, if you're poor, if you're uneducated, if you are very wealthy, if you are Caucasian, it does not matter. Lady Justice is finally blind. Every single person in this community has value, and we will fight for them as hard as we would fight for any victim.
And Willis stood firm that the alleged hate crimes were racially motivated.
And I am very comfortable in my decision to request sentencing enhancements based on the fact that race and gender played a role.
And DA Willis estimates a capital case like this could take up to 3 years to complete, and we appreciate that audio coming from Channel 11 here in Atlanta. In other news, DeKalb County continues to get more residents vaccinated. More than 2,000 people got the shot this past Saturday at the Mall of Stonecrest. In addition to the vaccine, they all received a $100 gift card, too. Not bad. People lined up in the parking lot as early as 4 a.m., and this is all part of DeKalb County CEO Michael Thurman's effort to get 50% of eligible residents vaccinated. Right now, the county stands around 47%. This is the fourth time the county has used federal stimulus money to offer these financial incentives. And finally, get your tailgate on, folks. College football is back, vaccinated or not, for the fans, depending on your team. Still, this weekend, here we go, UGA travels to Clemson. Georgia Tech plays host to Northern Illinois. Morehouse travels to the University of West Alabama. Georgia State will welcome Army. Now, this is just my Rose Scott prediction. That could be interesting. Panthers might shock them. Don't go put any money on the game. I'm just saying that could be interesting. Clark Atlanta heads to Livingstone College. Good luck to all. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now. This is 90.1 WABE. Atlanta's Choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Yes, Labor Day weekend in Atlanta. It is one of the biggest weekends for the city. We know usually there's a big college football game at the stadium. Black Gay Pride takes place. And also, of course, the annual Dragon Con convention. And as we all know, this time last year, not much was taking place Labor Day weekend. And Dragon Con was virtual. And while the pandemic continues, this year, the yearly gathering will take place, but with some strict COVID-19 protocols. But this fantasy, sci-fi, and all the genres-related convention will go on. And that includes a continuing approach to implementing more diverse content and, as they call them, tracks for the Dragon Con attendees. Dan Carroll is the Director of Media Engagement, and Jarvis Sheffield is Director of the Diversity and Inclusion Track. And Jarvis is also the founder of the Black Science Fiction Society. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Rose, for having us.
Jarvis and Dan, let's begin here. Is it fair to say that in years past, Dragon Con had a diversity and inclusion problem as it relates to some of your, I guess, tracks or forums, and unintentional or not? Is that a fair assessment, Dan?
I'm going to turn this over to Jarvis.
Wait, we can turn it over to Jarvis.
No. You've
been with Dragon Con for how long?
Well, okay, here's what I'm going to say. Dragon Con has always striven to be the place where anybody can find refuge. Anybody can find a place to celebrate the things they like. And that goes all the way back as long as I've been coming to Dragon Con. Dragon Con has been a gay-friendly place, a place where minorities can find expression. We have gone out of our way and not like some bad way, but we have made an effort to make sure that Dragon Con was going to be the place where everybody is safe, regardless of sex, gender. And for me personally, I know the effect of our disability services to make sure that Dragon Con is a place for everybody to enjoy things. But I'm going to say that one thing Dragon Con realized was that including these efforts and elements wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. And we needed to have that focus. And that is a better time for me to turn it over to Jarvis.
So, Dan, you're saying not only just diversity and inclusion in terms of access for all in terms of attendees, but also the content that you're providing. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think one thing I've noticed, I've been a fan for a real long time, Rose, and you know as well as I do, there was not as much material out there. There was not enough content that was showing the representation, and representation does matter. And I know myself, you know, I've come to a great understanding of what has changed from my youth, mm-hmm, through the 80s into the 90s and to now. And I just think it's amazing.
All right.
What's out there.
Jarvis, now it's on you. Through your lens.
Through my lens, after talking, I've just been with Dragon Con for 4 years. I've been a fan of Dragon Con for a number of years, but I'll echo what Dan said. It's always been inclusive. However, when Dragon Con created the diversity track, which I think is the first diversity track of any con, mm-hmm, it was an intentional safe space so that everyone could be represented.
And that was back in, I think, 2018 when you all debuted your diversity in speculative fiction and literature fandom fan track, if I remember correctly. And full disclosure, I moderated one of your forums as it relates to diversity, and I think women writers in science fiction. So you all awesome. Have, yeah. Now, awesome. I don't have a science fiction story inside of me yet, but you know, I'm working on it.
Well, it's in there. You just got to bring it out.
It's in there. You know, it's interesting because I remember a number of years ago and I spoke to Erica Alexander, an actress who she and her husband, Tony, were part of the graphic novel. And she talked about the challenges of trying to get science fiction and fantasy literature, trying to attract a publisher, also trying to get it beyond just a book as it relates to animation and things like that. Jarvis, is there still some challenges that people of color face in this arena that perhaps their white counterparts don't?
I think that goes without saying. However, we have to continue to push forward and not let obstacles stop us. I was talking to several people. We have to hit it on both ends, both pushing mainstream to do their part in making things diverse, as well as ownership, like Erica's doing with her comic book, Concrete Park.
Have you all, and Dan, you may know this, or Jarvis, you may know this, have you all seen an increase? And I don't know if you track this in terms of your attendees. I don't know if you can just gauge it by walking around, but have you seen a more diverse in terms of ethnicity, race, in terms of those attending Dragon Con over the years?
Oh, most definitely.
Dan, what do you
most
think?
Definitely. You can walk into Dragon Con. I tell people it looks like you're in Ready Player One. And so there's your living player, that video game movie. But there's, you see everything and all races, all sizes, all colors. And it's wonderful to see. People save up all year to be able to afford to go to Dragon Con. People work on their cosplays all year long and spend a lot of money to come out here and show their work. And over the years, you can just look at the pictures or look at the videos. It's been exponential in terms of participation from virtually everyone.
Dan, what do you think?
I think Jarvis obviously nailed a lot about what we're trying to do at Dragon Con and what we're achieving at Dragon Con. But I also think that it's reflections of the larger world and especially the larger geek world. Because we've seen in the past, I'm going to say 15 years since I started coming to Dragon Con, we've seen much greater representation and presentation from women creators, from Black creators, from creators who are non-standard, Hispanic creators, not non-standard, but the people who weren't getting a break 30 years ago, 20 years ago. They're making a voice for themselves and they're making themselves heard and they're making fans. And that's naturally going to be reflected in Dragon Con.
Well, Jarvis, let's get into what folks can expect. You all have this diversity and inclusion track. What's taking place?
Okay, we have programmed to cover everything from race, ethnicity, gender, socioeconomic status, nationality, citizenship, religion, sexual orientation, ability, or age. And we have a number of panels that we have each day. I am proud to say that Dragon Con has facilitated this diversity track, which makes it completely unique from any other event. Normally, other events, you go to them and you might have a diversity panel and then once that's over, after that hour, everybody goes back to normal. And that's it. Nice. See you later. See you, catch you next year. But at Dragon Con, we have programming the entire time, both virtual and in person. So it makes it really unique. And then we also like to party. We have parties virtually every night. We have one big party on Thursday nights, and then throughout the other nights, we have more intimate gatherings like a sketch party. We have a paint party and even a game night. So there's a more intimate setting for those that don't want to be around the big crowds and just need something unique to do. And so we have a lot of that going on. So I'm really excited about this year.
And Dan, before I let you all go, we've been talking about the diversity and inclusion track, but we got to remind folks too, y'all have some COVID-19 protocols in place, so you just can't roll up in there and just say, oh, I'm here.
Yes, we do, Rose. And we needed, and our fans needed, for DragonCon to come back because there were so many people missing something in their life because of DragonCon. And that is probably our biggest reason for coming back. But we also understood the reality of the world around us, and we responded. The first thing we did was we took a cautious approach. We made sure that when we announced our policies and procedures, we were working with the latest science. We have always told people that masks matter and that the vaccines work. The science behind them is solid. And we have shared that. And then we decided we were going to cap attendance in 2019. As you know, we had 85,000 attendees. We're looking at roughly half of that, somewhere in that range. And we're anticipating that we will have full capacity before the event. Secondly, we are requiring masks in all indoor spaces. Mm-hmm. We're working very closely with our hotel partners and the city and health authorities to make sure we're getting that impact. And most recently, we have announced that we will be requiring either a vaccine card showing full compliance, mm-hmm. or a recent test within 72 hours of when you pick up your badge. And we realized that we needed to go further. So we went ahead and we've worked with CORE and Fulton County to provide free vaccines on site. And we understand people are concerned that there might be side effects of the vaccine, but if you're getting the first shot of Pfizer or Moderna, normally there's very little side effects with that. It's the second shot. And then the other thing we're doing, Gross, is we're offering tests on site.
Okay. All right.
So
that sounds good. Jarvis, before I let you go, got a listener that wants to know, who is your favorite sci-fi writer, person of color? And Dan, you can answer that too.
Oh, that's very easy. My favorite sci-fi writer of all time is Octavia
Butler. I got you. Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. Dan, what about you? Do you have one?
I'm going to go with Dwayne Cook from DC Comics.
There you go. All right. Great talking to you, fellas. As always, I appreciate it. Dan Carroll, Director of Media Engagement, and Jarvis Shelfield, Director of the Diversity and Inclusion Track at DragonCon. All about diversity and inclusion this year, as always. Appreciate y'all taking the time. Take care now.
Thank you so much. Be safe. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
And Closer Look continues now. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. The numbers always tell the story. Since the onset of the pandemic being declared, keep in mind now the following number goes back to last year. 4,500,000 plus total child COVID-19 cases have been reported. Now, nationwide here, most recently between August 5th and August 12th, about 121,000 children tested positive for the coronavirus. This all coming from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. And get this, that was a 23% increase over the prior week. We know that school districts, not only here in Georgia, but all over the country, are implementing their own protocols. But the districts are also plagued by politics. So the question, what's working and what's not? Well, the answer varies. I'm joined now by Dr. Grant Rivera, superintendent of the Marietta City Schools. He's joined us so many times to talk about this, and we really appreciate it. Superintendent Rivera, thanks for taking the time, as always.
Thank you, Rose. It's great to be with you again.
Let's begin here, because as of last week, and your district reported 127 students and I believe 26 staff with COVID-19. That is the latest information, correct?
Yeah, correct.
And you had one, I believe it was a middle school or a sixth grade academy that had what might be considered a high number of cases. What can you tell our listeners about that particular school and where we are now?
Yeah, I'll speak really for that school and across the entire district. We implemented a mask mandate because we saw increasing cases across our district. We felt like that was one more layer. Is it perfect? No. Is it guaranteed to stop? No. But it's one more layer that we can take to keep our students and our staff safe. You know, candidly, Rose, I feel like this year, I said to everyone, last year I felt like we were fighting a virus. This year I feel like we're fighting each other. and the politics of it all, the dynamics of it all, it makes it incredibly challenging. At the end of the day, we've got to put every reasonable measure in place to try to keep our kids safe and then when possible in schools and learning.
When the school year started, correct me if I'm wrong, you all were mask optional, correct?
And then you correct.
And then you changed that to masks are now required. What type of, I'll use the word backlash, but what feedback did you receive from parents? Yes, some were in favor. No, some were opposed, I imagine.
Yeah. You know, candidly, Rose, I feel as if I get a lot of fan mail, and I wish the fan mail was about teaching and learning, but it's not. It's about COVID. It's about masks. It's about quarantines and really the polarization that exists now. For me, you know, our board asked me when we opened the school year to look specifically at Marietta City Schools data. And while that was somewhat of a reactive strategy, candidly, I respected that and I did it. We saw in our first 9 days of school, we could confirm one case that was linked to school-based transmission in the first 9 days. Mm-hmm. In the subsequent 5 days, we had 24 cases. And I think really quite candidly, the data was compelling enough that I said, listen, I'm willing to look at Marietta data, but I'm not willing to sit back and ignore it. So we made a shift to make masks mandatory, and I feel as if the data really drove that decision.
You mentioned school-based transmission because I think that's also at the core of the argument, depending on which side of you on. Some people will say, well, these cases aren't school-based in terms of the transmission. You say, no, let's step back here and understand that this is a part of these growing number of cases, whether it's in the Marietta schools or the entire nation. You can't just say it's not school-based transmission that's driving these cases.
Yeah, and I think, Rose, and I'll take your listening audience back to a year ago. We had the opportunity last December and January to be the first school district in the country to partner with the CDC to study school-based transmission. A team of 20 experts who converged on Marietta City Schools to teach us how to track data to EpiLink, and obviously there was a lot of testing that went along with that. We learned through that process how to contact trace in such a way that we could ask families reasonable questions. So for example, and there's two, and I'll say briefly to your audience, there's one idea is we try to discern when was a child most likely just coming from home to school versus when is a child out and about doing other social activities? When are they at a church retreat? When are they at gymnastics? When are they at basketball? And what we do is we try to discern between, is there other outside contact that could cause that? When that happens, we have to remove that as potential school-based transmission. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that becomes actually really obvious and somewhat simple, Rose, is that if I have one child sitting at a school table in kindergarten and the other three children around that child also test positive, we can start to see patterns where we can make reasonable decisions. And I think instead of ignoring the data, we have to respond.
So when you give that information to those parents who were in opposition of the mask, what's their response? Or even educators. I don't want to just pick on parents or anyone for that matter.
I mean, Rose, I feel as if we're fighting different battles by the day. You know, one day is the conversations around masks. And should we have masks or not? The next battle, I mean, really the email I got right before I started this interview with you is, should a child be quarantined if they're identified as a close contact from a positive case? And if so, how long? Should we require a test for them to return? Or should we not? And I think really there are a lot of opinions on this, depending on which social media thread you follow, which rabbit hole you go down. And I think for us, what I'm trying to do is step back and say, we are taking a reasonable approach guided by experts. Who am I to say that I know more than 70,000 pediatricians that are part of the American Academy of Pediatrics? You know, who am I to say that I know more than the health experts who are put in a position to guide us? So we try to have a degree of humility and deference to those experts. And again, just let the data guide the decisions and try not to let social media and Facebook dictate what we do as a school district.
The last time we talked, I think back in January, the district was operating on a hybrid model. Is that still an option?
We did. So we offered to our families. The answer is somewhat yes and no. I think the simple part is we did offer to our families, your child can come full-time in person or your child can go full-time virtual. I felt like families were owed that discretion. Mm-hmm. Now kids are 100% either in person or 100% virtual. We've got some situations where kids will shift depending on family dynamics and what have you. So yeah, we try to accommodate family needs, but what's different than last year is kids can't flip-flop back and forth by the day like they might have done last year. We're trying to get a little more stability for children and consistency for adults.
If you're just joining us, I'm in conversation with Dr. Grant Rivera. He's the superintendent of Marietta City Schools. And of course, we're talking about COVID-19 and obviously and back to school, in-person instruction. Early on, when you talked about the CDC and how important it was to offer COVID testing. Now, this partnership is continuing, and you all are taking a step further. You're including families if they want to get tested. Is that true?
Yeah, Rose. So I'll take you back 2 weeks ago. About 2 weeks ago, I had a kindergarten teacher who contacted me on a Sunday, and she said, Grant, I've been sitting waiting for a test at Walgreens for 7 hours. And I don't know what else to do to get a test faster. We had families who were going out and purchasing for $50 or $100 kits to do at home. And this idea of health equity and access, I think, is just falling apart in front of us. So we partnered with a local primary care physician to offer COVID tests for students, staff, and families. We do it Monday to Friday, 8 to 12 each day. We're looking to expand those hours. We did over 700 tests last week. And it was really guided, Rose, by the simple belief and the simple value. I can't wait on external people to fix an internal problem. I can't wait and assume that when I drive by a testing site and there's 100 cars waiting, that they're going to fix that problem so my kids can get back to school, my teachers can get back to class. So we really just took it upon ourselves. We found an external partner. Our central office staff is out there assisting with insurance and processing, moving cars and processing paperwork. We're doing everything we know to do, because I don't feel like we can sit back and wait for somebody else to fix our problem.
I want to focus on the educators and the staff for a moment, because sometimes it appears they tend to get lost in the conversation. Because, listen, we're talking about the lives for everybody here. For your educators, and I know that last week we mentioned that Decatur City Schools might become one of the first districts in the state to say, look, we're going to mandate the vaccines for educators and staff. Is that something that you all and the board would consider?
So, Rose, I'll answer your question based on how I feel today. You know, nothing about COVID you can predict, so maybe things feel differently in the future. But Marietta has offered 13 different vaccination clinics on our campus for our staff, our students, and our families. We know that we have close to 70% of our staff who were vaccinated through us, plus anybody else who got vaccinated outside of what we offered. So we have a very high percentage of staff who are vaccinated. At this point, we are not having conversations, and I'm not in a place where I want to mandate a vaccine, because I think that is a personal decision. Mm-hmm. I think if we started to see more adult transmission, then maybe there's a need to go back and revisit that. Maybe there's more education to help people understand why the vaccine matters. I'm trying to walk that fine line as an educator and not make a mandate for one real simple reason. Well, two simple reasons, Rose. One is I want to respect the decision of each person, as opposed to have an employer mandate. But there's also a very practical reason. Rose, we don't have teachers applying for every position, every vacant position. Like, we're having a difficult time staffing classrooms. Math teachers and special ed teachers don't grow on trees. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we potentially put a mandate in place that prompts us to lose valuable educators who are veteran, I think ultimately hurts children. So maybe we can allow people to have that discretion, encourage them to get it, but also at the same exact time put safety protocols in place like masks and other things that create us from having vacancies that we can't fill in a pandemic when nobody really wants to walk into a classroom these days. So we're trying to balance it with the greatest degree of sensitivity, but I think the data is compelling.
Meanwhile, obviously you all are in the business of educating, which is what you all do. How are the kids? How have they been adjusting to getting back in school? And as you walk around some of the school buildings, and I always start with the kindergartners. How have they been?
Yeah, well, Rose, I have a kindergartner. She walked into that building for the first time this year and couldn't be happier. She doesn't care about wearing a mask. It's not that big of a deal to her. It's interesting. I've been talking with teachers, kind of getting a pulse of, like, how are the kids a week or two or three in? And I've had multiple teachers who are veteran educators say to me, I've never seen the kids so engaged, so happy, asking such thoughtful questions, leaning in. I think these kids have been hurting for the last 18 months. And the idea that we could try to offer them, and in Marietta, 94% of our kids are in person consistently Monday to Friday. The fact that we can offer these kids an opportunity to get back in school where it feels like maybe what it used to some small degree, I think matters. And I think a lot of kids have missed the relationships. They've missed the camaraderie. And hopefully we can continue to do that safely.
And finally, you have a town hall coming up on September 21st. How do you plan to maneuver around the message of not politics, but people, as it relates to this pandemic and wearing a mask and all that?
Yeah. So, Rose, we offered a town hall 2 weeks ago. We'll offer another one in September. It's my effort to consistently engage the community. I share with them the current data. I share with them our current protocols. And then I sit back and I answer questions. And really, for me, it's about transparency and it's about over communication. a lot of people can take issue and attack me personally or attack me professionally, but what they can't say is that we're not over communicating and they're not transparently walking through the protocols and the data. Like, that's my responsibility. We don't have to agree, but I think we have to over communicate and be transparent.
Dr. Grant Rivera, superintendent of the Marietta City Schools. As always, we appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much. We'll have you back.
Thank you, Russ.
Tell that kindergarten, hang in there. It gets better.
Absolutely, I will.
And Closer Look continues now. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Throughout August, there's been awareness regarding the nation's Black-owned businesses. Yes, it was Black Business Month, and amid the global health crisis, we all know, right? It has not been business as usual for any business owners, but Black-owned businesses have been disproportionately impacted. We know this. According to University of California, Santa Cruz, 41% of Black-owned businesses closed due to COVID-19 compared to 17% of white-owned businesses. And to put this also in perspective, according to the 2021 census on minority-owned businesses, out of all the businesses in the U.S., just under 125,000 are considered, quote, Black-owned. Well, join me now to talk more about this is Joy Womack, the founder and CEO of Goody Nation. I love that name. And Shani Godwin, the founder of Joy Economics. Enjoy that name, too. Thank you all for taking time. I appreciate it.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Let's begin with a little background on your respective entities. Shani, I'll start with you. What's the backstory for Joy Economics?
Backstory, in a real brief nutshell, is I started a marketing communications firm, Communicate USA, almost 20 years ago, a year after 9/11, pivoted through the mortgage crisis of 07-08, found myself at the top of the pandemic, and lost 85% of my revenue. $1 million business just kaput in 1 hour. And through that climb and scale over the $1 million mark, really realized the stress that comes, that sucks the joy out of growing a business, and used the opportunity in the pandemic to reinvent the business. And we're back on track in the black and on our way to $2 million plus, thank God, but really opened up an opportunity to really inspire and teach women, especially women of color, how to grow and scale using the currency of joy as the way that they measure their success.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. And Joy, let's talk about Goody Nation. How'd that come about?
Oh, long story. So we started out as a hackathon for good. And so we matched up skills-based volunteers with nonprofits to solve technology challenges. And so Hackathon for Good being Atlanta, hip hop, Goody Mob, Goody Hack, right? And so we evolved to this thing called Goody Nation. And today, currently, we are a national nonprofit that's focused on closing what we call the relationship gap for tech-focused social entrepreneurs and the diverse founders all across the country.
You all heard those statistics I gave you coming in. When you think about how the pandemic has impacted not just all of businesses, but when you break that down, you peel back the layers, so to speak. Shani, I'll start with you. The impact that this pandemic has had on Black-owned businesses, that's not lost on you.
No, not at all. I mean, we're about to celebrate 20 years in business, and I had the wherewithal, the fortitude, and God gave me the vision to create Joy Economics as a cultural shift platform for our organization about 4 years ago. So at the top of the pandemic, at its height, I was sitting on an idea that I hadn't been able to activate, and that's not always the case. You know, I'll be really honest with you. I can't even take the credit for us being here. I truly believe it was just God ordained. My CPA said, I have no clue how you kept this business afloat. You have crazy sick cash flow management skills. But when we unpack like what's truly needed to survive, it is truly a lot of foundational things that we had in place going into the pandemic, plus the faith to keep going. So the day before that first PPP round vanished, if you didn't know how to move and maneuver and pivot, you were going to get lost in the sauce. We banked with a big major bank, and I could see we were going to be high and dry because that was not moving. So I called my CPA. She called in a few phone calls, got us with a small bank. And Rose, it was crazy. We literally got the money the night before it ran out. And that was the first round PPP. So relationships matter, infrastructure matters, and knowing how to maneuver and get things done matters.
Well, and Shani, sounds like you had that foundation, but Joy, as you know too, and Shani, you know that for every, that doesn't apply to every small business, and particularly if you are considered what, maybe a mom and pop, or you just starting out, and also you're in that phase where you're still sort of filling it out as you go. Joy, what did you hear from other small business owners, minority-owned business owners, as what they were going through when this pandemic all started and continue to go through?
Yeah, I do want to double down on Shani's point about relationships and how they matter. But what we saw from our founders was, you know, they didn't have some of the foundational skills to your point. And so, you know, even having a personal relationship with a banker mattered. And so when it came time to activate these opportunities, you know, things move slower than normal. One thing I learned during the pandemic was that access to information is a true privilege. Like, everybody knew a guy. I got a guy that can get you this, or something's about to happen, just prepare. And so we saw that Black founders in particular in Atlanta, small business owners, were not as connected to the people in the know in which they really needed to be. And so we've been focused on making intentional connections to people that provide capital, to people that can provide strategic advice to them, and to people that can also offer up customers and things of that nature.
Well, for someone listening says, okay, you all keep talking about partnerships and that's great, but to even have partnerships, there has to be a beginning somewhere. You know, how do you begin to do that if you're just starting out? Because you're so focused on trying to get the product, trying to get the service, get the website. Do we have social media? Do I get my cousin to do the graphics for the, you know, what have you, the website? So y'all know, we got to bring in family because we're out on money.
Right.
Capital is an issue. So, you know, how do you even begin to where do you go to build these partnerships? Shani?
I'll speak for myself. You know, I started this business when I was 27 years old. So there's no way I had the networks and the knowledge and the know-how, just really had the confidence. I think it's important to remember, you know, a lot of us as Black people and people of color, we're pulling up to the entrepreneurial table as first generation. And this game has been going on for years and years and years. And so one of the very early things we established from an infrastructure standpoint was getting certified as a minority-owned business through National Minority Supplier Development Council, and then also as a woman-owned business through Women's Business Enterprise. If you're 51% woman-owned or 51% majority-owned minority, those networks are invaluable. Yes, they give you opportunities to compete for contracts, but when, you know, the stuff hit the fan last year, those were also my funnels of where information was coming to. I'm very well networked in the Atlanta business community. So every single network in those years and years of showing up at conferences and events, and, you know, we show up thinking, let me do a quick little elevator pitch and get the deal, but it's so much deeper than that. People have to know you, they have to trust you, and they have to be willing and wanting to help. So it's that know, like, trust factor that got people to answer my phone calls and got me moved and maneuvered and rerouted. And those relationships were not just people of color. It was my whole network, from corporate to the small business to the anyone I knew that was able to ultimately help. But one of the first things we did was get certified.
What about finding a mentor? Joey, I'll start with you. What about finding someone in this space to sort of guide you? You know, did you have a mentor?
I've been blessed to know a lot of people in my entrepreneur journey over the past 20 plus years. And I've had lots and lots of mentors, and that's why we really baked it into our program. And so kind of going back to the previous question, I know, like, many, to Shani's point, many Black founders are first time founders. But the thing is, with Black people in this country, like, entrepreneurship is baked into our DNA. As my good friend at the Small Business Administration, Natalie Cofield, will say, that we're not new to entrepreneurship. We're true to this, right? And so everybody knows someone that sold something on the corner, or, you know, someone's family member sold a freeze pop, or whatever you call it in your area of the country, right? And so for us, one of the things that we do and we found success with is connecting founders to other people who've been there, done that, mm-hmm. for an assessment of where they sit relative to a few things: launching their product, their readiness to take on capital, and their readiness to take on large companies as partners. And so what you see is that, like, if you think back to those memes you see on Facebook around people working out, mm-hmm. like, here's how I view myself, here's how other people view me in that reality. We found success with triangulating that difference to seeing how founders, you know, view themselves versus how mentors view them, and then helping them create priorities and goals to level up. And so in the process of that assessment, evaluate, or that evaluation process, relationships are developed between someone who can give you a one-off set of advice mm-hmm. for office hours, to turn into a coach, to turn into a mentor, and then eventually we've seen people turn to actual advisors for the company.
And so, you know, Joey mentioned, you know, all those about creating, you know, relationships. Now, Shawnee, I want to switch for a moment, because you're saying we're going to do all that, but your movement also includes mental health.
Yes. So, you know, we are in a culture, and I am effectively calling myself, this is the part of culture that I am trying to cancel. I think particularly in communities of color, you know, as Joey said, access to cash matters. But we get so focused on the $1 million or the financial goal that we can burn up all of our resources, all of our energy, and all of our time scaling and growing. And in order to scale and grow, so you mentioned, Rose, people love to start a business and go straight into the marketing mm-hmm. space. And that's my wheelhouse all day. But, you know, great marketing can only stand on a good foundation. And so one of the things that got me when I grew and scaled over the $1 million mark, what nobody prepared me for, was at the point that you're running a 7-figure business, you better have that infrastructure right, or you are burning the midnight oil and burning yourself out. So we created Joy Economics as a redirect to really get people to think about what makes them happy and start to redefine how we measure your success. I tell people, I'd rather run a $200,000 company that is profitable than a $2 million company that's burning cash at a $3 million clip.
Stressing you out.
Right. And what good is that to have the optics, the look, you know, to chase the bag, as we say, is going to keep you burned out and stressed. So it's just really a way to help people manage their mental health along the way, because at the point that you're burning, you know, your engine out, you're not even enjoying this thing that you're using to create wealth for your family, opportunity, et cetera. And so just a lot of good foundational business principles behind the scenes on that.
And Joy, I want to give you an opportunity to take Goody Nation a little bit further, because you all are also, you're in this space of what you call social entrepreneurs, you know, or I remember we did some segments a while back on, you know, the conscious of capitalism. I got a lot of emails about that. But take it further, when you talk about social entrepreneurs, and someone says, okay, but Joey, can I make a little money with this social, being a social entrepreneur?
No, yeah, for sure. And so we say all social entrepreneurs, we're referring to founders who want to make the world a better place while also building really quality, high quality businesses. So you think founders in the health space, you think founders in the education space, you think founders in the financial inclusion or fintech space, and those working on sustainability, environmental, climate change, and things of that nature. The interesting part about that is that for many Black founders in particular, it's almost natural to us. And so, because in many cases, an entrepreneur in general is simply just building a solution to a problem, usually they have experienced or witnessed themselves. And so for African-Americans, for Black people in the U.S. and in many cases Atlanta, like, we've seen so many problems that we want to do something about it. So you see companies like Gooder, where the founder is Jasmine Crow, or Gap, and focused on taking excess food and redirecting it to people who are in need. You think companies like GABA, where the founder is Candace Blacknall, helping diverse students going into medical school be better prepared for those opportunities, so that we're developing the next generation of Black doctors. So there is a huge opportunity, and these companies have the potential to be valued at $50 million, $100 million. So there's an ample opportunity, particularly in Atlanta, the home of civil rights, mm-hmm. to lead the nation as it comes to developing social entrepreneurs.
As we wrap up, the statistic I've read coming into this, if you can look into your crystal ball the next year, Shawnee, I'll let you go first. Looking at how optimistic are you that, and I don't know how many of those 41% of minority-owned businesses will be able to come online, but the outlook you see for minority-owned businesses within this next year, because we're still in a pandemic.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm hopeful. You know, I believe that all bad things can be turned around to good and for good. And I encourage people, and it's one of the ways we were able to kind of breathe life back into our business. And it's just really what we're all about with the Joy Economics Coaching Program, is figure out the thing that you do effortlessly. And you know it because it's the thing people ask you for over and over and over. In our business, that happened to be coaching and working with women entrepreneurs, because people were asking for that mentorship. And start to pivot and move your business toward those things. And when we did that, instead of trying to continue saving what was dying, that momentum began to shift. So like the old economy as we knew it is dead. Mm-hmm. And if you're still trying to serve that old economy, then your business is dying or has died. So mm-hmm. you've got to be able to shift and adapt your offerings, the best of who you are, to this new economy, unfortunately, that we've found ourselves in. And when we've done that and seen and helped people through our Joy Economics program do that, then they breathe new life into it, and it kind of comes back to life.
All right, Joey Womack, I'll give you the last word. What do you think a year from now?
I'm excited. I think what you're going to see in Atlanta among Black entrepreneurs is those taking advantage of the creator economy, creating tools to help creators, and taking content creators themselves and turning them into the next generation of multi-million entrepreneurs. And what that means for the Atlanta, or city of Atlanta overall, metro Atlanta area, it's going to do, you know, wonders. So super excited for what's next.
All right. Joey Womack, the founder and CEO of Goody Nation. Shawnee Godwin, the founder of Joy Economics. We'll have links to your sites on our website. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it. Good information. Inspiring messages. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program, or any other for that matter. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as on our podcast. Subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.